Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. The time is 2:43 p.m. We're in Bell's Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building in the nation's most beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, May 7th, 2025. Members present are Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, Senator Yunt, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Senator Merrick has also joined us. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Welcome everyone to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to extend an especially warm Labor and Commerce welcome to our recording secretary, Carrie Tupo, and our LIO moderator, Marnie Provost. We have four items on our agenda today. First up is Senate Bill 170, Gaming Electronic Pull Tabs, followed by Senate Bill 158, Cook Inlet New Admin Area, followed by Senate Bill 149, Utilities Renewable Portfolio Standard, and Senate Bill 35, Delivery Network Companies. First up is Senate Bill 170. During our hearing on Monday, we finished invited testimony. Today, it is my intention to take some public testimony on this bill and set the bill aside. I'd just like to remind members that we are working toward a draft committee substitute to make some changes that have been suggested to the chair, to the committee, and some others have some ideas about changes as well. We will take all of those suggestions under advisement and talk about ideas for a CS, but if you do have changes, please get those to my office as soon as possible. Once again, by way of a brief recap of the bill, the goal of this bill is to modernize our charitable gaming statutes and maximize revenue for our charities and nonprofits without turning charitable gaming into anything that resembles gambling and all of the social ills that go with it. I think it's important that we maintain kind of the cultural nature and flavor of charitable gambling and keep it fun, keep it social, and make sure that folks who do play paper pull tabs or rippies or electronic pull tabs, that they know that they're raising money for a good cause and that it is fun and enjoyable for them, and most importantly, so that these charities can enjoy revenue from this type of activity and are not looking to the state government for that revenue. So with that in mind, I will now open public testimony on Senate Bill 170. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify to this item? We'll go now online to Krista Foley. Ms. Foley, thank you for joining us. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, senators and representatives. My name is Krista Foley. I am a department commander for AMVETS Alaska, so I represent veteran service organizations today. I come today to express my concern with some of the way the bill is written. I feel that it leans heavily towards operators and forget about small VSOs out here that 95% of our folks helping with us raise money for our charity are nonprofits and they're volunteers. And limiting what we can do for our each individual organization, whether we want to do it or we don't want to do it, between tablets only or other devices that we can use within our organization, I think that should be left to choice for the organization and for the committee, for the space that they have, or the business that they have. Veterans, we're limited to a closed, we're private clubs, military affiliated, and we're not open to the public on a regular basis. Only on some limited basis do we let the open public come in. Everything else is by membership. And so that limits exponentially what the people that participate in what we do. I've done some research through my organization and other organizations across the country that have gone to this electronic pull tab system in their areas as well, and how it has benefited their VSOs, their veteran service organizations, across the country, so that we have the ability to raise more funds and do that. And it's been incredible what they have done. I'm hoping that you keep in mind that as small volunteer organizations, we don't have the resources of the people that hold everybody's permits and can do it out in the public. Sorry, I'm nervous.
No, thank you very much, Ms. Foley.
When you move forward, that you consider that, give us our own option. Make sure that we're doing this for the bill, and we can figure out the regulatory stuff down the road, and not put all of those rules on us.
Ms. Foley, thank you for your testimony.
We don't have that.
Your time has expired. Your time has expired. If you have some additional written comments that you would like to submit, anyone is always able to submit written testimony to the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee by emailing the address slac@akleg.gov. Thank you. We'll go next to Michelle Sass. Ms. Sass, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I'm a member of American Legion and Veterans Foreign Wars. I personally see the direct impact that the charitable gaming has on our community. SB-170 in its current form puts this kind of grassroots giving at risk. I believe that SB-70 supports modernized charitable gaming, which is what we all want, and I applaud you for putting that forward. But in its current scope and structure, it represents an overreach that risks dismantling the organization it claims to support. CSOs in particular, because that's where my heart lies. Handheld only mandate, I believe it's flawed, one size fits all model. SB's restrictions to handheld devices only for ETABs creates a significant staffing burden for small organizations. These devices require constant monitoring and direct interaction. It forces nonprofits to hire additional personnel to rely on that, and we may not have the funds to do that, even if we get additional funds from the gaming that we're looking to include. The lodges and fraternal organizations and small town charities deserve a choice in these types of machines. And then I noticed that a lot of this presentation that was given is based on Wisconsin. Wisconsin is currently the only state that limits charitable ETABs to tablet handheld devices. We should be looking at all states for that across the board and what the benefits are in each area. The payout limits, we believe, should be raised to $7 million across the board. This levels the playing field for everybody, and it prevents us from getting to the end just before the end of the year and having to cut off charitable gaming because we've reached those limits. In the economic times, I think that's appropriate. There was some testimony on the invited testimony. There was a petition that was submitted by Tudor Bingo. It did have 306 signatures. These were all from patrons. I suspect that is a supposition. But the true stakeholders are the permit holders, veteran service organizations, fraternal groups, small charities organizations. We're directly impacted by this legislation. Tudor Bingo is a large operation with ample space and staffing, well-positioned to accommodate handheld
devices. Ma'am, your time has expired. Could you please wrap up your testimony?
Certainly. I just think that we need to look at some other options or amending the legislation that you've proposed, which we truly appreciate because we are looking for modernization. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go next to Mr. Charles Boring. Please state your name and affiliation for the record. You have 2 minutes.
My name is Charles Boring. I'm an Anchorage resident homeowner for the last 40 years plus, and I followed the electronic bill gaming last year and testified last year as well in support of the gaming for electronic gaming. As of yet, an American Legion lifetime member and the MVETS lifetime member, the bill, as I see it, it focuses a lot on a lot of details for operations, for operators. But the nonprofit, I think everybody, if all the members of the committee don't know, in order to get a gaming permit, you have to have 25 residential members in Alaska to have a gaming permit. Well, that obviously is one of the reasons the operators help all the other ones that can't have that. But for all of the veterans organizations, it's a small group. And actually, most of these members are not very big. the livelihood and existence of our organizations, the veterans organizations especially, is largely dependent on gaming and pull tabs. I understand the discussion on the rest of the part, but I really like the idea of the flexibility on the limits. As it states, I think the way it's two for pull tabs and 4 million for electronic. I would like for that to be open. I was part of a gaming setup once and we got cut off, and because we spent too much money. If we have the flexibility of having those separate out a little better, I think that would be a good idea, having just a total set. If you knew 7 million, if that's a million, that's what they wanted to use. I think that would be a better way to handle that, so we could have the flexibility to do what we want. And I certainly think the choice of the device is an important issue. I understand the thoughts about, you can't legislate morality and how people do this, spend their money. We won't exist without having as much gaming as we can get. The more the better, at least for our existence. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, sir. We'll go now to Kayla Hansen. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony. You have 2 minutes.
Hi, my name is Kayla Hansen. I'm with the Soldotna Chamber of Commerce. I'm their gaming manager, and I want to voice that I am for the e-tabs. The current legislation, I don't believe is broadened or is going so much towards the permittees. Down on the peninsula, we don't allow operators, and so we are permittees only. And I think it's important that we have our own decision on what we are allowed to use and what devices. I mean, we are in Alaska, so you have communication problems and internet problems. And I mean, what's the tablet gonna have issues with, you know? And I believe that each organization should be able to decide what is good for their organization. And I just want to make sure that the legislation are, you know, keeping in mind the permittees, because we are small and we each of us only have about one store. So we can't compete with the big people. And so just making sure that it stays level for the big people and the little people, and that we have an option of choice. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Hansen. Go now to Cody Oatman. Mr. Oatman, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Hi, my name is Cody Oatman. I'm a business representative for the Alaska District Council of Laborers. So we at the Laborers, we represent around 5,000 working Alaskans, from the North Slope down to the Kenai Peninsula. And I wanted to thank Senator Bjorkman for his work to support Alaska nonprofits and ask the members of the body to support Senate Bill 170. We have a scholarship fund that receives proceeds from charitable gaming to support students pursuing educational opportunities. With the Labor Scholarship Fund, gaming proceeds go to support students pursuing vocational training as well as higher education. And we believe the electronic pull tabs modernize charitable gaming and will lead to additional revenue for Alaskan charities. We appreciate that the 13-inch tablets will retain the social aspect of charitable gaming so that people can still interact while gaming. The tablets will enhance accuracy and streamline accounting for charities. Since tablets will keep operational and maintenance fees low, that means more revenue would be going to charities that support our communities. These tablets are manageable for shipping around the state with reasonable costs. Affordability means keeping revenue for charities across our communities. By contrast, pull tab cabinets are less likely to involve social interaction during gaming and have higher costs for operations and maintenance. And we believe that electronic pull tabs strike the right balance and would be a valuable opportunity for Alaska nonprofits. I want to thank you for your service and for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you very much, Mr. Oatman. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Hearing and seeing none, at this time we'll close public testimony. We will keep public testimony open for a future hearing. Apologies. Are there any comments or questions from committee members? I'll just again provide some rationale for the policy choices that I've made in this bill draft that have been raised kind of repeatedly here and invited in public testimony. There's a very strong desire by members of the legislature as well as the public that charitable gaming not grow into something that looks like casino gambling. Having machines that are in a cabinet that very much look like slot machines goes further into those waters than I think are pragmatically possible or providing a public good in keeping charitable gaming in its current flavor where it is fun and enjoyable in a social setting. That's why the piece of legislation before us does not allow for cabinets or tabletop devices. In regards to the conversations about limits, the limits that we have proposed in some communication that the committee has received as well as hearing from public testimony today are quite large. Why there are lower limits is that provides for more nonprofit permits to be played through at an operator's location or a multi-permit beneficiary location, meaning that an operator or a multi-beneficiary can play through permits up to a limit and raise money for one charity, and then they can go on and raise money for another charity. With higher limits, you limit the amount of charities that are able to raise money through nonprofit gaming. You put in place that limit, and it limits how many charities can raise money from this type of activity. So that's why the limits are what they are. They're increased, but they are not increased so much as had been proposed here in public testimony. Once again, if you'd like to make changes, you have anyone has questions or concerns about the bill, please let us know. We're happy to have conversations about policy choices that have been made in the bill and why. But we're putting together a committee substitute, which will be before the committee at a future meeting. Is there any further questions or comments from committee members? Okay, hearing and seeing none, at this time, we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next item. We're back on the record. It's 3:02 p.m. Next up is Senate Bill 158. With us to present the bill is the award-winning Conrad Jackson. Mr. Jackson, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please state your name for the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. In short, Senate Bill 158 is a slightly technical bill that proposes a new administrative area be established on the east side of Cook Inlet, where the east side set net permit holders have historically fished. Gill nets have been used in some degree in the waters of Cook Inlet for thousands of years. Set netters fished between the traps in the early days of commercial fishing, and then after traps were outlawed, independent fishermen continued to catch salmon using gill nets to be sold at canneries and feed their families. For over 150 years, salmon caught on the east side of Cook Inlet have been feeding people both locally and around the world. This rich renewable resource not only fed local families, but provided financial support for those families, for local businesses, was really a way of life. These beaches and the beach sites taught a real I guess the best way to put it is a really strong work ethic to generations of children growing up on the peninsula. It also helped maintain those cultural ties to prior generations. As pressures from other user groups increased, the set netters who fished the east side of Cook Inlet were subjected to a reduced number of fishing opportunities, also known as fishing periods or openers. Since 2017, the implementation of paired restrictions, maybe a term folks haven't heard, but since the implementation of paired restrictions, even a more drastic impact on the fishery was felt. In Cook Inlet, paired restrictions mean that certain fishing activities, like sport fishing for king salmon or set net fishing, are automatically closed when king salmon numbers in the river are deemed too low. The target species of the set nets that we're talking about, the east side set netters, are red salmon. Their catch of kings is minuscule, but they have been subject to paired restrictions and continue to be managed uniquely. The areas they have fished for generations are shut down, while others in Cook Inlet continue to fish. Obviously, a rather unique situation. The bill does not propose to change the allocation of fish in Cook Inlet. It does not propose to change the fishery itself. The bill merely asks that the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, or CFEC, create a new administrative boundary area around this unique fishery on the east side of Cook Inlet. On the east side, the upper subdistrict of the central district of Cook Inlet, to be more precise. It will allow the commission to more easily manage the permits and will allow opportunities for self-determination by the permit holders in the new area. Mr. Chairman, we have on the phone invited some permit holders from the east side set net area. Their families have been impacted by these closures over the years and the changes to the fishing area. We also have Mr. Glenn Hyatt from the CFEC. He is the chairing commissioner with CFEC, and it will be his agency who is tasked with redrawing those boundaries. If you'd like, Mr. Chairman, I can go through a sectional on the bill as well.
Thank you, Mr. Jackson. Yes, if you could provide a sectional analysis for us, I think that would be most excellent.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members should have in their packet a map that looks a little something like this. If not, I can certainly make some copies. This helps you to see the area that will be encompassed by the new administrative area. Mr. Chairman, if I could have a brief at ease, I'll make some copies.
We can share.
Looking to my right and my left, it looks like we have enough maps.
Okay.
Please
thank continue. You. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The changes to statute in Senate Bill 151 begin in Section 1, which amends the uncodified laws of the state of Alaska, adding a new section that establishes that creating this administrative area is in the public interest. Section 2 amends AS 1643-200 by adding two new subsections, the first of which establishes an area in the upper subdistrict of the Cook Inlet Central District as a distinct administrative area. This area would be made up of the six statistical areas identified on the map in your packet as you may have highlighted copies or you may have black and white, but they would be statistical area 24421 and 22, statistical areas 24431 and 32, and moving farther north, statistical area 24441 and 42. These, as you'll see, move from about just north of Nanilchik up the beach to Boulder Point, which is well north of the mouth of the Kenai River. The second subsection that is added to 1643-200 would provide that an individual who has a set net permit for the Cook Inlet Central District is not entitled to a set net permit to set net in the new administrative area unless their permit has been reassigned to the new administrative area. So we are, again, limiting access to that fishery to the folks who have historically fished in those areas, in those statistical areas. Section 3 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section which provides how the commission will determine whether an individual is reassigned an entry permit for the new administrative area or is issued a permit for the Cook Inlet Central District. Section 4 amends the uncodified law of the state of Alaska by adding a new section which defines the appeals process in the new administrative area, and this section provides that a provisional license will be issued pending resolution of that appeal. And finally, Mr. Chairman, the final section provides for an effective date clause that makes the bill effective January 1 of 2026.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, this time we will go to invited testimony. First up, we have Commissioner for the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, Mr. Glenn Haight.
Greetings, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Glenn Haight, Commissioner with the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission. I don't have a whole lot to offer. I think Mr. Jackson did a good job. But I will just mention a few things from CFEC's perspective. This is pretty simple. The bill creates the area. That's something we do have authority to do, but this does that for us. And then it creates criteria to have people come into the area. And typically for the commission, it has to base that on economic dependence and past participation. And this is slightly different from that, so I don't think we could do this. So that's really important with the bill. And the other thing it does is it sends appeals to Superior Court as opposed to running it through CFEC. So there's much less that we would do in that regard. So it's quite simple from our perspective. We would do a regulation project, receive applications, of which the information we already pretty well know. It's either with DNR or with Fish and Game. So that's pretty simple to verify. And then we would need to do some coding to the licensing system, and those folks would be brought into the new area.
Very good. Are there any questions for Commissioner Haight about the rationale and why this piece of legislation is needed?
Shall I address that?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so you may know that for a number of years this group has sought to do a buyback, and that's had a series of legislative bills over the years and just hasn't passed. They had things a lot of complication to it. CFEC really carried out most of the buyback effort, and then there was a dollar figure put in there that was a disincentive for some folks. So this doesn't do that. This creates the area. And what also you have in legislation is the ability to create a regional fisheries association specifically designed typically for a fleet that wants to do a buyback. This was created during the Legislative Salmon Task Force in 2004, 2005. And so this is the body that would carry that out. Whatever becomes of that, they would hold the elections, they would find the resources, and they would do it themselves. And it's probably the right way to go about it. CFEC's role in that would be pretty minimal over the years. We would likely give them some language that they would use to help close out permits, and then we'd go through the process of revoking them once they had conducted their buybacks. But it really is on them, and it's fairly simple from our perspective.
Very good. And just to clarify, the way I look at this and the rationale is the new administrative area will make sure that the people who have historically fished on the east side of Cook Inlet, that they are able to be there and have some kind of self-determination and figure out what it is that they want to do with their permits, and that other people won't be able to come into this new administrative area and take advantage of an opportunity that they really should not get. That's kind of where I'm at. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Up next is Lisa Gabriel. Ms. Gabriel, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman and committee members. My name is Lisa Gabriel. I live in Kenai, and today I'm testifying on behalf of myself and my family. I've been on Eastside Setnetter for over 39 years. I'm calling today in support of Senate Bill 158. Senate Bill 158 seeks to create a new administrative area in Upper Cook Inlet to regulate certain commercial set net permits, specifically that area known as the Eastside Set Net Fishery. This legislation will make the Eastside Set Net Fishery its own administrative area, thus allowing them to regulate independently of the other set net areas in Upper and Lower Cook Inlet. The statistical areas that encompass the Eastside Set Net Fishery are very different than the other statistical areas, as it includes harvest from two of the most prized rivers in South Central Alaska, the Kenai and Kosciuszko Rivers, both rivers being gems of the Kenai Peninsula. The value of the new administrative area is that it will allow CFEC to manage our fishery more easily. We are managed uniquely, and with that, we need an administrative area that reflects the uniqueness of that management. With the new administrative area, we will have the ability to self-determine what we want our permits, fishery, and family businesses to be. With the Eastside Set Net Fishery qualifying for federal fisheries disasters for the past 6 of 7 years, it's apparent that we need to do something to change the trajectory and right the ship. Being lumped in with all other areas in Cook Inlet has not allowed us to do that. In a fishery resource with unlimited sport, guided sport, and personal use fisheries, and limited set and drift net fisheries, we need to be able to self-determine our best outcome. Sitting on the beach year after year is not the best outcome for our fishery. I urge you today to support Senate Bill 158, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Gabriel. Up next is Mr. Gary Hollier. Mr. Hollier, please state your name and affiliation and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman and committee members. My name is Gary Hollier. I'm representing myself. I'm a 71-year-old lifelong resident of Kenai and an Eastside Set Netter. I support SB 158. I received an original set net permit for Cook Inlet from CFEC in 1975. I participated in an Eastside Set Net fishery for 54 years. I'm speaking on behalf of myself, my family, and many other set net fishermen around me who fish. I and my family have multi-permit, multi-generational set net sites just south of the Kenai River in statistical area 244-32. The set net fishery in Cook Inlet is comprised of 5 sub-districts. SB 158 would make the Eastside Set Net Fishery, which is in the upper sub-district, and part of the central district, and who harvests predominantly sockeye salmon heading to the Kosciuszko and Kenai Rivers, a new administrative area. This administrative area would be independent of the rest of Cook Inlet. The Eastside Set Net Fishery is managed differently from the rest of Cook Inlet. We are unique in the regulations and restrictions that are put on us. We need a unique management area that reflects the uniqueness and differences of the management strategies that are put on us. With a new administrative area, CFEC will be able to manage our fishery more easily. With the new administrative area, we will have the ability to have self-determination about what we want with our permits and our fishery. The last 6 out of 7 years for the Eastside Set Net Fishery has qualified for federal fisheries disasters. This summer, the Eastside Set Net Fishery is closed to gill netting. The last time I checked, 80% of the Eastside Set Net fishermen are Alaska residents. SB 158 is on the right track to help a 150-year-old plus fishery that definitely needs a change from the status quo. We need help from the state of Alaska. Please pass SB 58 out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hollier. Are there any questions from committee members for any of the invited testifiers? Seeing and hearing none, any committee discussion on this item? Seeing and hearing none, we will set Senate Bill 158 aside, and we will take it up at a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for our next bill. We're back on the record. It's 3:20 now in Belt's Room 105. Next up is Senate Bill 149. With us to present the bill, we have bill sponsor, the Honorable Senator Bill Welikowski, and his staff, Hunter Lotsfeld. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please put yourselves on the record and begin your presentation of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Bill Welikowski, State Senator for East Anchorage. I'm joined by Hunter Lotsfeld, the staff in my office. And I appreciate you hearing this bill. We do have a couple invited testifiers, so I'll keep it short. And this is a bill for a renewable portfolio standard. And I had a good conversation with some folks yesterday at the utilities and at the university, and they asked, well, what are you trying to do with this bill? And fundamentally, the bill arises because we have a crisis in Cook Inlet, as you all know. Despite the fact that we have enormous amounts of gas right at our doorstep, it's not being developed. And so we went the path back in 2010, and I was here for that, and I was a co-sponsor of the bill. House Bill 306 this was a package along with some other significant energy legislation, but that set a non-binding goal of 50% of the state's energy from renewable energy or renewable sources by 2025. 2010, that's 15 years ago, we're supposed to have 50% of our state's energy from renewable power. Fast forward, here we are 15 years later, non-binding, and we're at 12% statewide, 15% of the rail belt renewable energy. And the goal at the time was it wasn't carbon related. It was the recognition that we were spending, again, at that time, huge amounts of money to try to incentivize gas in Cook Inlet. We're still trying to incentivize gas out of Cook Inlet through various measures, royalty relief and other measures. We've probably spent hundreds of millions, perhaps over $1 billion in incentives for Cook Inlet, and it's just not happening. And the utilities were all at the table back in 2010, and it just hasn't happened. And so we ask ourselves, well, you know, we like to use a light touch in the legislature. We don't want to force anybody to do things, but at the same time, we have businesses and we have constituents who are on the verge of running out of gas. We saw that this past or last January, where we cold day almost ran out of gas, and so this bill uses a little heavier touch, but we're still working with the utilities to try to do it in a way that it's the lightest possible touch that we can, but at the same time we'll have the impact of incentivizing independent power producers. I genuinely believe that this bill, and you'll hear some testimony on this, will provide us low-cost energy, affordable energy. It will diversify our energy resource, our energy portfolio, and it will have the action of incentivizing independent power producers and utilities to provide a more diversified, reliable, affordable energy source for the whole state, particularly the rail belt. I'll stop right there, Mr. Chairman. Like I said, this is not a novel concept. This has been introduced for a number of years. 30 other states do this. Very conservative states like Texas has a renewable energy standard that they actually met. They've had it for years. So this is not a conservative, liberal, this is not a Democratic or Republican issue. This is just about getting us reliable, affordable energy into our system. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Welikowski. Mr. Lotsfeld, would you like to take us through a sectional, please?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Hunter Lotsfeld, staff to Senator Welikowski. And just the preface here, this bill is in flux. We are working with Representative Holland in the House on the companion for this bill. And to respect the committee's time, we didn't want to introduce the CS just yet. So this will be for the first version of the bill, but the conversations we've been having with utilities have been very productive, and there are a lot of changes that we're considering. So Section 1 amends AS 4205780. This would require that the Integrated Resource Plan accommodate the ability to meet the goals of this bill. Section 2 amends AS 4205785A. It adds a new subsection, essentially clarifying the Regulatory Commission of Alaska's pre approval process for large energy facilities, so it is not detrimental to complying with the standards of this bill. Section 3 amends AS 4205785C. This exempts the pre-approval for renewable energy projects for that first goal in an attempt to try to get them on board as quickly as possible. But that, just a note, that in Section 7, we sunset this clause. Section 4 adjusts the numbering of 4205785E, but it also defines renewable energy resource. Section 5 creates, this is like the meat and potatoes of the bill, creates Article 11A under 4205, Renewable Portfolio Standard. And just to quickly walk through the main points here, in .9000, this is setting the target goal of 40% by 2030 and 55% renewable by 2035. 905, this is to try to incentivize the development of projects. And there's different incentives for specific types of projects, such as wind. We're giving a 1.25 multiplier for large wind projects, essentially because of their scalability. .910 governs the use of renewable energy credits and which credits qualify. This is one of those things that is going to be changing. .915 establishes the non-compliance fee, which is $45 per megawatt hour, that a utility would be under meeting the goals, which again are 40% by 2030 and 55 by 2035. .920 establishes the exemptions for not meeting the goal. And those exemptions are a multitude, but to be quick about it, essentially if a utility has signed a power purchase agreement, even if they've not met the goal by that time, they would still be qualifying. Or, for example, if they were working with an IPP, had a power purchase agreement, but that project, for whatever reason, was not able to supply the power, they could get a waiver. But also, if there's a fire, there's a war, there's a pandemic, any sort of potential disruption to meeting that goal would potentially qualify them for a waiver, and they'd go in front of the RCA for that. .925 provides for definitions. Section 6 amends AS42.45.110A, and this is, again, a section that we will be taking out completely. Section 7 is that sunset that I referenced earlier, and Section 8 establishes an effective date of July 1st, 2025. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions from committee members? Thank you very much, Mr. Lotsfeld, Senator Wilkowski. We'll go now to invited testimony. First up is Erin McKittrick from the Southern Kenai Peninsula. Ms. McKittrick, congratulations on your re-election to the Homer Electric Association Board of Directors. Thank you for being here today. Please put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Erin McKittrick. I'm an independent energy analyst based in Saldovia. And as was just mentioned, I do sit on the board of the Homer Electric Association, but I do not represent HEA, and I am speaking today on my own behalf. So what I will present today is a preliminary independent analysis of this RPS based on public data and published things. No one paid me for this work. Slide 2, please. So what I'm going to try to address today is a first basic answer to two really key questions. Are the goals set out in this RPS achievable, and what are the economics? What are the potential savings or costs to energy customers? Next slide. So here is a graph that basically shows the past and present rail belt energy. Green bar at the bottom is current renewable energy. That's mostly hydro with just a little bit of wind and solar. And the rest is fossil fuel generation is mostly gas with a substantial amount of coal and oil in the Northern Rail Belt. And the dashed lines there are the targets as laid out in this bill. Next slide. So here you can see one way that these targets could be met based on in the pipeline projects that have been extensively studied and could be available before the first deadline. So the majority of the power here, that big green slice at the bottom of the graph, is wind from the two proposed wind projects at Little Mount Susitna and Shovel Creek that are being pursued by Alaska Renewables. And those two projects alone would more than meet the first target. The next light green line on the top is modeled on Puppy Dog Lake Solar Project. The original contract for that project was canceled, but HEA has since made the decision to build its own version of a solar farm. And then the top is Dixon Diversion. That is the expansion of Bradley Lake Hydro, which would put more water behind the dam that's being pursued by Alaska Energy Authority. Final thing you can see here is there's a dashed line that says unadjusted. That is what the actual physical penetration of renewable energy would be under this scenario. So the reason that it's higher than that is because of the multipliers in the bill that were mentioned earlier. Some of this counts for more. So you put that all together and the first target is more than met and the rail belt would still be a little bit short of the second target. Next slide, please. So this basically lays out all the details of the projects that I included in the last graph. This is, of course, these aren't the only possible renewable projects. They're not the only way that you could meet the targets, but there's a reason I chose these ones because they've all been studied extensively. They all could be available by that end 2030 date. And they've all been modeled integrating into our current grid. And by that, I mean that none of them would depend on large new transmissions, such as a line across Cook Inlet or a substantial increase in the capacity transfer between the different rail belt regions. And so for the wind, that's been shown in the E3 study, and there's another more technical EPS study that also looks at the integration. Both the solar project and the Bradley Lake expansion, they're much smaller and they're also being actively pursued on our current grid. Distributed solar is something that I did actually include in the previous graph, but you could not see it because it is too small to really show up, but it's modeled here as continuing to be added at the same level it has been in recent past. So the wind projects by themselves would meet that 2030 target, and all of them together would be just a little bit short of the 2035 target. Next slide, please. So, elephant in the room, what about those fees? So I move now to the potential costs. So I've shown how the targets can be met within the pipeline projects, what happens if they aren't met. So in the absolute worst case, so we still stick with that 15%, nobody builds anything else. You'd have to pay, you know, the entire amount of those fees. So Rail Belt Utilities collect around $930 million from their members every year. And if you add the maximum fees possible to that, you would raise it by about 5.5% in that first target period and 8.5% in the second target period. Next slide, please. So these fees, the $45 a megawatt hour, are acting as a cost cap. They're pretty much set the worst case scenario. It's not that those will get paid, but that it's not possible under this legislation to need to pay more than that. But really, they kind of are, these maximum fees are really a straw man scenario, because you have to make a lot of assumptions. You have to assume to get there that no projects are developed at all, not any of the ones I mentioned or any others, and that no contracts are signed for any future projects, and that there really weren't any other reasons for waivers. And so if you look at the details of the bill, there are all kinds of reasons that there could get the waivers from having to pay these fees, including just making good faith efforts to comply. So if you look at the straight up numbers here, like $51 million, it's a big number. And it's big because the whole system is big, not because it's a big piece of anybody's electric bill. So if you take that straw man worst case scenario I mentioned and, you know, put it in terms of someone's residential electricity bill, it would be equivalent to about a 1.2 cent rate increase, or $6 on a monthly bill. For context, Rail Belt Utilities, on average, that's about the base rate increases we've seen in the last, say, year and a half. There are other things, details here. There are provisions that fees can be spent on renewable energy projects, or that they could be paid towards customer efficiency or distributed generation, and I haven't modeled any additional savings to customers from that here. Next slide. So, kind of more relevant than that straw man scenario of what happens if no one even tries to comply is what happens if you do. What are the, you know, costs here of all the different forms of energy? And of course, the future ones are necessarily speculative, but this graph kind of shows some of our existing energy costs and then some estimates for future. So on the left-hand side, we have a selection of current energy costs. The lighter red at the bottom is, you know, fixed costs of these power plants, and the darker red is the fuel costs. So you can see here that currently power coming out of the natural gas plants is a little less than 8 cents per kilowatt hour. And that new contracts line shows what power would be coming out of those same plants on FERC's latest contract price. So there's no gas plant that's running solely on that $12.30 gas today, but that's where Cook Inlet even is headed. Next, we have some the Healy coal plants and the North Pole oil plant. Those are quite expensive even today. And then a selection of current renewable projects, Bradley Hydro, Houston Solar, and Fire Island Wind. Then on the other side of that dashed line is what might happen in the future. So Hook Inlet Gas is in crisis. Everyone knows that. So that first bar there is looking at what the power would cost coming out of our gas plants at a range of reasonable LNG import prices, given what's been mentioned. I think I've got $12 to $16 there is the range. And so you can see that's a lot more expensive than it is today and more expensive than any of our current renewable energy projects. The next bar, that NREL Renewables, is from NREL's study a year ago on a different renewable portfolio standard, but their power prices for solar and wind. And that's based on current federal law today. So the tax credits we have right now have an impact on those prices. After that, I've got a couple bars there for wind and solar, estimating what the range might be if the tax credits disappear. It's speculative, of course. I tried to be pretty conservative, and you can see that now the range overlaps imported gas, but is on average a little cheaper. And then finally, for Dixon diversion, I just used the numbers the state put out directly. And so if you look back at that LNG import price, you know, I mentioned earlier the maximum fees would be about a 1.2% rate increase. This is a 3 to 5 cent rate increase from those imported gas costs. Next slide, please. So future gas generation costs are expected to be substantially higher than they are today. Our other fossil generation costs are already quite high. The current renewable energy projects we have are cheaper than those future projections. And if the tax credits continue, the future renewable energy projects are likely to be a lot cheaper. If they don't, the costs are more similar, but there are probably, you know, some of the possible projects will still beat them, depending on exact details. Next slide, please. So in conclusion, currently in the pipeline projects can mostly satisfy this. They can meet the first target and get a good ways towards the next. This diversification could save the rail belt a lot of money, and any potential fees would be modest and well within the range of what we see for energy cost changes all the time. Thank you for your time, and I will take any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. McKittrick. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, we'll go now to Mr. Matthew Perkins. Mr. Perkins, please put yourself on the record and begin your testimony.
This is Matt Perkins, CEO of Alaska Renewables. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Excellent. Thank you for all your hard work after many months in session. I personally appreciate it. Alaska Renewables is a development firm working on a number of power plants across the rail belt. We have a diverse track record across many technologies. Our team has designed and sold equipment for gas pipelines across Indonesia, coal mines in China, gasification plants in China, gas turbines in North America, and wind and solar. So I think we proudly wear the badge of being economists and engineers around the fastest and most cost-effective way to address the energy security and military energy security issues that Alaska faces. Last year, we brought on a major multi-billion dollar power plant owner-operator to assist provide the long-term capital in our first fleet of projects, which are a couple of wind farms around the rail belt. We're very proud of that partnership. Bringing capital to Alaska is not easy. Alaska is far away, but this firm has experience operating power plants from Hawaii to Maine, so all over the U.S., but missing one corner, and in particular experience in regions that have harsh environmental and grid issues, which are the exact kinds of issues that have prevented renewables from being developed easily in Alaska in the same way they have propagated so quickly across the lower 48 and most of the world. First of all, I want to say I would never advocate for mandating the purchase of my product. What I'm here for today is to explain the market realities as we see them and how a well-crafted RPS could impact that. We're not deeply involved in the development of this bill, although we do serve on the board of local renewable energy and environmental organizations. And we're also not here to advocate for our specific projects. We're simply here to provide information as is useful for you in making a decision. Thank you for your leadership. So I mean, what outcome does this have? I mean, I think Aaron's presentation is pretty robust around kind of the economic reality. I want to speak to the competitive landscape. This will attract investment capital to Alaska. And I think one thing we see that is really stark between Alaska and most of the United States is the presence of IPPs. In most of the lower 48, you have an even balance between utilities and IPPs, which creates a competitive landscape and drives free market economics. You see about 50% of power generation owned by IPPs and 50% owned by utilities. And I'm not advocating that that's the right ratio, but I'll highlight that in Alaska on the rail belt, we see about a 1% of energy comes from IPPs. And we simply might ask the question, why? So our primary goal is to bring, which maybe makes me a terrible entrepreneur and a great engineer or a great local Alaskan. My primary objective in general, as I look at this, is to say, this would bring more competition. And I think that's healthy. Most of the people on our team are endurance athletes. We like competition. It makes us better. It helps our community and it helps our utilities. The second thing I talked to is creating regulatory stability. As we look across many generation technologies that we have invested in and are increasing our investments in, solar, geothermal, batteries, wind, et cetera, we crave, as long-term development infrastructure developers, we crave regulatory stability. We have enough challenges developing projects, from permitting to engineering to logistics, and having regulatory uncertainty is one I would love to reduce. And so to the degree that the state can create regulatory stability in a visionary and long-term way, it vastly improves the ability for outside investors and local investors like us to plan. Planning is key for infrastructure. If you can't plan, then you can't build infrastructure. And then the final thing is to drive diversification of resources. I think what strikes me about this bill is that we're almost completely on natural gas in South Central and vastly on coal in the interior with plants that have had challenges. And diversification of resources, simply as a system engineer, improves my statistical confidence that we can serve our military bases, we can serve our communities, and that my own lights will stay on. So I think, you know, I'm happy to speak about some of the other development realities today. But, you know, the bottom line here for us is we do welcome the state taking leadership in creating that environment. I applaud some of the efforts and consensus and debate over the last couple sessions on energy as relates to electric utilities. I think we've made great strides. And I also think the utilities, you know, frankly, are making great strides in analyzing how to diversify their own resources. So we have a lot of the ingredients on the table to put this together. And the question now is, where does the legislature want to take it? I really appreciate your time. Thank you for listening, and let me know how I can help.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perkins. Senator Yontes, question.
Yeah, through the chair. First, thank you. I really appreciate the sponsor bringing this forward. I'm a huge fan of renewable energy. It's not an area I know a lot about. And so if the gentleman that just spoke could speak to the stress that it can sometimes put on the grids when, or at least what I'm being told by members of our local utility board, when you get a larger amount of wind or solar than you had anticipated or how that affects the current system and the grid, and then in how you would store it would be the next part of the question, if it's possible, and where that technology is going, and then maybe speak to what you believe would work the best in the wintertime in Alaska. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Young, these are three of my favorite topics, and I assure you, you do not want to be in this room long enough to hear me talk about all the different elements of them, so I'll try to be succinct. Absolutely. Intermittent renewables cause different grid behavior, and that grid behavior 20 years ago would cause issues like voltage flicker, and potentially even blackouts. And I'd say that's the case with any new technology learning curve. At this point, we've done wind and solar, even each about $1 trillion times at this point. We've figured that out, and our engineering teams and our third-party consultants hired by us or the utility are the best in North America who are not doing any science on this. It is pure block and tackle engineering. And so we are in those detailed discussions every day. I was in a utility office this morning for several hours discussing this topic. It's a matter of working through engineering, and I'm excited because I think this summer, although the results will probably still be confidential from the technical and grid security nature, we will get to some of the design guidance around that, which actually is remarkably fast, but it does reflect the fact that we now have 20 years of experience with inverter-based resources. I think the simplest way to kind of sum it up is, if you program it correctly, it should work, and you need to confirm that afterwards. And there is a great case study in Texas of not that we did the right engineering studies. I wasn't involved. I mean, the industry, and afterwards did not configure the power plant correct according to what the study said should be configured for low voltage ride through. And guess what? What was predicted happened, and the equipment didn't do what it could have done. Inverters are way more sophisticated than conventional power plants, and so you can actually do more things with them. So just like anything else, strengths and weaknesses, it's about good engineering. Storage, I'd echo kind of the general philosophy of what I said. For intermittent renewables, battery energy storage and some long duration energy storage, whether that's gas, which is why we love gas and we want gas to be a part of the solution here as part of the chocolate and peanut butter of making renewables work. Gas is an excellent form of storage. Heat is the second choice. Batteries are a second choice. So there is a mix of those that is being deeply studied, but both internally by our engineering team, but also in a more collaborative manner with the utilities. And then the winter time. Obviously, solar is not going to get you through the winter, but it can help defray the use of gas and reduce the stress on the system. What we found with the wind farms is that by designing them in geographically diverse locations where the wind may not be blowing in one location, but it is blowing in the other, we get the benefit of the Alaska winter winds, which are way stronger than the summer winds. And that's coincident with when our grid peaks in its need. So we actually see as the vast majority, maybe not vast, the majority of generation for wind happens in the winter, not in the summer. And that's good because that matches our load needs. I'm happy to expand on any of this. Like I said, be careful because they are some of my favorite topics. But yeah, great questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Perkins. Anything further? Nothing further. I have one question, either for Ms. McKittrick or Mr. Perkins. Has anyone in your group assessed the potential renewable power especially I'm interested in your graph, Ms. McKittrick, about achieving the goals. What would the Susitna-Wantana Dam look like in that graph?
Sure, I can take that. So the Susitna-Wantana Dam, you know, didn't meet, so the thing criteria would meet in what projects that I was including is that, you know, it is renewable and would be a large amount of energy, but it could not be realistically available before the end of the first target, nor is it in the no major new transmission. So the last time the state studied Susitna, they proposed that it would need about $1 billion of transmission upgrades to the existing system before you could add Susitna. The actual power produced would be about 59% of the rail belt's total, so would meet both targets on its own.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski. Any wrap up, sir?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you. We'll be working on this over the interim. It's apparent that we're going to time out on this. But I do look forward to conversations with the committee members and with utilities and the IPPs to figure out whether this is something that will work for Alaska, and if so, how we can make it so that it provides a diversified energy source at an affordable rate for Alaskan consumers and businesses. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Any committee discussion on this item? I'll just say a couple of things here for myself. I've made no secret in the past that I'm not crazy about any kind of fines that utilities would have to pay as a result of a system like this. When utilities pay fines, that means that the people who turn on the lights and pay the bills for the lights, they pay the fines, and that's us. There is immense potential with Susitna-Wantana. My utility, as well as all of yours, have talked for many years about completing the permitting process for that project as well as moving forward. With some of the conversations that we heard earlier today on the budget and wanting to have a vision for Alaska moving forward, investing in a project ourselves as Alaskans and not relying on some outside entity to come in and save the day with a project like this, I think is something that matches the vision for how Alaska moves forward into the future. It's something that we could invest in firm power that is reliable, and once we build it, you're talking a nickel, a kilowatt hour off the dam face. So I think it's projects like that that we need to consider more thoughtfully. And even now, as we have rate cases in front of the RCA that would put on the rate base the cost of importing natural gas, the cost of doing other things, I think it's time, beyond time, to look for longer-term solutions. And I think a large hydro project is one of those. So thank you. Thank you, Senator Wilkowski, for bringing this forward. And we will set it aside for consideration in a future meeting. We'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the next bill. back on the record. It is 4:03 p.m. Next up is Senate Bill 35. With us to provide a brief recap of the bill is once again Conrad Jackson. Mr. Jackson, please place yourself on the record and begin your brief recap of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, Conrad Jackson, staff to Senator Bjorkman and the Labor and Commerce Committee. SB 35 amends statutes related to workers' compensation. This will align individuals who provide delivery services through delivery network companies with the individuals who provide services for transportation network services, network companies. The legislation will define these workers as independent contractors, provided that they meet statutory criteria. Currently, delivery network companies are not defined in statute, which has led to confusion and litigation across the country, threatening these services that customers value and depend on. Roughly 90% of the digital network drivers work less than 10 hours per week. These drivers usually provide delivery services to supplement their income, so they work. They can also work their full-time job, or potentially go to school during the day and still make a few bucks as a side hustle. Most drivers prefer to remain working as independent contractors, so they have the ability to work as much or as little as they would like. Senate Bill 35 would create a level playing field for drivers involved in delivery and transportation network companies in Alaska. This bill will eliminate the inconsistencies in statute related to workers' compensation and create opportunities for individuals who use and rely on these companies to supplement their income.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jackson. Are there any questions from committee members? Seeing and hearing none, at this time, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 35. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time, I'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 35. John Finley from Uber is online. We heard from him as invited testimony at our last hearing on this bill. He's available for questions. He has also submitted answers to the committee's questions, which we will send out to members shortly, if have not already done so. One thing I wanted to make clear about my intent for this legislation is to just reiterate what Mr. Jackson said, clarify in statute that, in fact, drivers for delivery network companies are not currently employees under statute, and that as they are otherwise logged on to the digital network, as outlined in the bill that was passed in 2017 to cover transportation network companies, covering companies like Uber and Lyft, that these folks be treated as independent contractors. I understand and think that it is reasonable to have questions about when insurance applies for auto insurance, as well as should there be some kind of occupational insurance. I think those questions are rational to ask and worthy of consideration. To that end, working with the Division of Insurance to craft policy and language that would provide an instrument that would make sense for a subcontractor or independent contractor, like a person who drives for a delivery network company, to be able to have an expectation that, yes, they have communicated with their personal auto insurance company that they are doing this delivery work, they have coverage that one would expect as they are driving for a delivery network, and also what happens to a delivery driver if they get out of their car and slip on the ice and hit their head. So to answer those questions, it's not a short project to craft that. So I don't know that it's going to be something that we can solve here in the very near future. But coming up, I want to make sure that we get the policy right instead of just doing something to get it done. So that's kind of my rationale where I'm at on the bill. Any questions from committee members for Mr. Finley or anyone else? Senator Yunt.
Thank you. Through the chair, and again, I apologize. So can we just go over real quickly again the workman's comp requirements and who this may add into that? And I apologize. I'm just, just want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly.
Very well. My understanding of the statute is right now, drivers who drive for Uber and Lyft are exempt from workman's comp because delivery network companies were not prolific when the statute was passed in 2017 governing transportation network companies. The law is gray on whether or not the drivers of delivery network companies are subject to workers' comp. That's an open question. However, the statute under the Transportation Network Companies Law that was passed in 2017 provides that exception for if people are otherwise logged onto the digital network, essentially meaning an app for Uber, that they would also be exempt. One could make a strong argument that language would encompass a delivery network company. Currently, I think the goal and the idea behind the transportation network company was to exempt people who are delivering pizzas for a delivery network company or groceries or what have you, to treat them in the same way as you would treat a driver for Uber or Lyft. So the goal of this bill is to clarify that question in the law so that delivery network company drivers are exempt employees from workers' comp. Yep.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Do you have a question?
Not a question, a comment.
Yeah. Okay. Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to say, because I asked questions during the last hearing about occupational injury insurance, and there were two organizations that had it and one that didn't. And I really think that these independent contractors should have some kind of protection in case of injury. So I'm going to have an offline conversation and the possibility of bringing forward an amendment that will require these companies to provide occupational injury insurance for these drivers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Gray Jackson. Any further committee discussion or questions on this item? Seeing and hearing none, at this time we'll set Senate Bill 35 aside for future consideration. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Friday, May 9th, when we will take up a number of items, including Senate Bill 147, Pharmacist Prescription Authority, Senate Bill 117, State Commission for Civil Rights, Senate Bill 158, Cook Inlet, New Admin Area, Senate Bill 116, Campaign Finance Contribution Limits. I don't think that's right, but take a brief at ease. Back on the record, indeed, we are absolutely not taking up campaign finance in Senate Labor and Commerce. We will take up House Bill 116, which deals with commercial fisheries insurance pooling, Senate Bill 159, training and employment programs and contributions, and last but not least, Senate Bill 172, Occupational Therapy Licensure Compact. As there is no further business to come before the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee today, we are adjourned at 4:12 p.m.